The Pentagon says that it will send roughly 1,000 additional troops to the Middle East. That's after the Defense Department says that it has proof Iran attacked two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman last week. Iran has denied any involvement, but the country's atomic agency says it will ramp up its production of uranium, planning to surpass the amount allowed under the 2015 nuclear deal.
President Trump says he called off a strike against Iran because too many people would have died.
Well, Facebook says it's entering the cryptocurrency market. Earlier today, the company announced a new digital currency called Libra, and it'll be used on a blockchain-based system called Calibra.
Powell has made it very clear. He'll give us the rate cut if we need it, which means that if we get the rate cut, he thinks the economy's weakening.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Oil prices rising 9% this week amidst Middle East tension as Iran shoots down a U.S. drone. Also, the market's reacting to the FOMC meeting, implying rate cuts are ahead of us, and gold breaks out to record levels. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up, Dave Nikoski talks about this breakout in gold. Last week, we talked about gold could hit 1,700 if it crosses over 1,400. Dave's going to tell you why he thinks that's a possibility. Robert Rapier will also be joining me in talking about the mispricing that's going on in the energy markets, in especially one particular sector of the market that is a screaming bargain because of not understanding fundamentals. Of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets. And then Chris and I, in the big picture, are going to talk about the FOMC meeting, why the markets are going crazy this week, and dissect the entrails of that FOMC statement. All of that coming up in today's program.
This week was, again, all about the Fed and trade with China. Let's kick things off with a reminder that the market turned around on June 4th from a 6% correction in May as Fed Chair Jay Powell acknowledged the difficulties of trade disputes with Mexico, China, and the rest of the world. Let's take a listen.
I'd first like to say a word about recent developments involving trade negotiations and other matters. We do not know how or when these issues will be resolved. We are closely monitoring the implications of these developments for the U.S. economic outlook, and, as always, we will act as appropriate to sustain the expansion with a strong labor market and inflation near our symmetric 2% objective.
So Powell used the same language this week with the Fed's June policy statement. Here's what the Fed did, about 4 points. Let's look at the first one. They left rates unchanged, so they didn't drop the rates, although there were a few that wanted to. They removed the word patient. So they're no longer being patient, considering that was a pause that they had in raising interest rates. So now they're no longer patiently waiting to raise interest rates. They're acknowledging the uncertainties about the outlook. And then fourth, they said that the Fed will act as appropriate to sustain the expansion. Again, using that same language as he used a couple weeks ago. There was a dovish dissent by St. Louis Fed President Bullard, who's also a voter, who wanted a quarter point cut. And Friday, Minneapolis Fed President Kashkari, a non-voter, said he advocated for a 50 basis point cut this week. Right now, the Fed futures are predicting a 72% chance of a quarter point cut at the end of next month. And I think with another month ahead, the Fed is hoping to get maybe some more clarity on the U.S. and trade to see where things are going there with China. And hopefully we don't hear anything more on Mexico. But if we're looking at another escalation like we saw in May from the breakdown in trade negotiations, the Fed will likely act immediately. Gold has had a very good run this month, rallying from close to around 1285.86 on May 29th to touch 1415 intraday Friday on expectations the Fed was shifting its tilt from patient to accommodative. On that note, let's turn to the second catalyst this week. That was trade. Trump tweeted early in the morning on, I believe it was Tuesday, that he had a very good telephone conversation with President Xi of China. He also added, We will be having an extended meeting next week at the G20 in Japan. Our respective teams will begin talks prior to our meeting. So the market took a nice risk-on tone on that news, especially in semiconductors who benefit the most on a trade agreement between the U.S. and China, especially because some of them aren't allowed to do business with companies like Huawei. Since then, we've heard Vice President Pence has canceled a speech on Monday that was going to be on China, and it was considered to be probably a very targeted and maybe finger-pointing type of a speech. So that was canceled. And that was seen as definitely a positive development as an effort to keep things kind of calm before actual talks next week. Let's talk about a few more side stories this week that weren't as hugely sweeping as the Fed and trade, but manufacturing continues to languish in the U.S. We got a big note from the Empire Manufacturing Survey, which fell to a contraction reading of negative 8.6 for June, and that's the largest monthly decline on record. It was down 26 points. The Philadelphia Fed Manufacturing Surveys also had a large decline to basically flat growth at 0.3, down from 16.6 from the previous month. So both readings merely reaffirmed with the market that the Fed has leeway to cut rates. So it seems like any kind of bad economic information we get right now is going to be good monetary news. Lastly, I wanted to talk, Chris, about some more things about what has happened this week regarding the tensions between the U.S. and Iran, which essentially increased from those, if you recall, the tanker attacks from last week that helped lift the price of oil. This week, the Iranians shot down a U.S. drone in international waters. Trump tweeted immediately, "Iran made a very big mistake." And he told the media, "Wait and see," in reference to his response. But when he added that it could have been maybe unintentional, it seemed to kind of lower fears of an immediate conflict. And he later said that he had contemplated bombing, I think, 3 Iranian targets, but the loss of life would have been disproportionate to us losing merely an unmanned vehicle. Obviously, the dollar amount is there, but oil rose from that news. Oil was up from 52.75 to about 57.60 on the Iranian news, as well as from, there was a drawdown this week of 3.1 million barrels on inventory data for West Texas. So that's pretty much what's going on this week. A lot of the Fed, a lot of the trade talks, nothing kind of new there. But definitely new from the Fed. The past 2 weeks, we've seen a humongous rally in the markets from that. And that's mainly shifting their tilt, now looking more, as they say, supporting the market. That could mean a cut maybe as soon as July. So we'll have to see, Chris. But next week, we'll definitely talk more trade.
Hello, everybody. This is Rob Bernard. The Federal Reserve wrapped up its 2-day meeting on Wednesday with very dovish comments and hinted the next direction in Fed funds rate would be down. Their reasoning? Muted inflation, global growth, trade concerns, uncertainties, and cross-currents around the world. This is on the heels of the ECB President Mario Draghi's dovish comments on Tuesday. The U.S. 10-year hit a 1.97%, and the German 10-year Bund hit negative 0.32%. Sounds like the central banks may be concerned about deflation. That's all, folks.
Good intentions hold us back. You should stand down.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
So this week, Facebook announced the Libra cryptocurrency, and this is an entire ecosystem. One very interesting factor about this is that they're not going to peg it to the dollar. And so for the first time, we're seeing a corporation coming out issuing a currency that is not pegged to the US dollar, which has all sorts of implications. If Facebook holds reserves in the model that they're suggesting, it's going to be a global, privately held central bank.
Volatility is back. The stock markets are pivoting, and experts are predicting another recession. How will your retirement weather the storm? Are your investments fortified? Do you have a consistent source of income? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help you answer these questions and plan for the unpredictable. We monitor the markets, interest rates, and the economy so you can focus on doing the things you enjoy most. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Start planning, stop worrying, and make the most of your retirement. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the market seemed to like the words coming from the Federal Reserve, with the futures market pricing almost a 90% probability of a rate cut coming next week. Gold prices breaking out, stock prices breaking out, and possible conflict in the Middle East. But the market seems to ignore it. Joining us on the program from Vermilion Research is Dave Nikoski. Dave, I want to begin instead with the stock market. Let's begin with gold, because on the day you and I are speaking, gold is breaking out. You just put out a piece. It's at a critical juncture. Let's begin with gold. What do you see happening here?
Yeah, Jim. I think the important thing is, you know, gold is breaking out to multi-year highs going back almost 8 years. There's some resistance at the 1400 level, but I think that's far enough gone in the past that we have to pay much more attention to the 1360 level, which it's failed to break out a number of times over the last 5 years. I think it's decisively breaking out. And I think, the one thing that we've highlighted in our group a number of times is that you've had the euro in a downward wedge and you've had the US dollar in an upward wedge. And usually those reversals can really change the direction of those currencies or whatever you're looking at. And in this particular case, I think the dollar is suggesting that, you know, there's some weakening going on. The ECB talked about a 10 basis point cut, and we're talking about a 25 basis point cut with a possible additional 25 before year end. I just don't think that the dollar is going to stay at its mighty highs. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing in gold is I think investors are realizing that there's some issues happening in the economy.
Let's talk about the FOMC meeting and the pivot that we saw from the Fed from the beginning of the year. The futures market, Dave, is implying that there's probably a rate cut coming next month. We'll have to wait and see, but the market seems to like it. But I also want to go to the point when the Fed starts cutting interest rates, they're not doing it because things are going well. They're doing it because they see something wrong or things are going in a direction they don't want to see.
That is correct. And I think in this case, the U.S. Has been doing obviously much better than the rest of the world. If you looked at the S&P 500 against the emerging markets have been in a 10-year downtrend. I think they're more concerned about the global growth than anything. But of course, along with that comes it in the form of weakness for imports and exports for U.S. goods, of which the U.S. has significantly less exposure than anywhere in Europe. So we're somewhat isolated, but not 100%. I think that's what the concern is that we are seeing some slowdowns here in the U.S.
Dave, as you look at the markets right now, you know, on the day you and I are speaking, the S&P is hitting a new record high. Let's talk about the follow-up markets from the Dow to the Russell. What are you seeing there in terms of confirmation?
Well, interestingly, the Dow is pretty darn close to its October highs. It's not quite taking out that high. I'd like to see better breadth in the overall market when it comes to the sectors that have lagged, and that would be your financials. That's really going to be I think the driving force behind that is going to be the divergence between the twos and tens are going to help them if that starts to widen out again. I'd like to see the industrials, which the industrials are starting to, you know, show some signs of strengthening. But again, it's you have some areas of the economy that are just not reflecting that strength. That would be the automobile industry, which certainly supplies a lot of jobs here in the U.S. I would like to see, you know, the materials and the energy sector reverse to, I think, reflect that the economy is strengthening, because I believe that those cyclicals are going to be helpful in terms of pushing the market up to new highs.
You know, the interesting thing is if you look at the automakers announcing plant closings, layoffs, and then this week you have the steel companies announcing the same, shuttering a couple plants. I think it's U.S. Steel. and they cited what's happening in the manufacturing sector. So as you look at the industrials, do they reflect the same weakness that we're seeing in the economic numbers?
I think that depending on what groups within the industrial sector, you can certainly see weakness. Obviously, the automobile component suppliers. You know, what's interesting is the rails have been hitting highs nonstop through, you know, even since the correction in December. But if you look at the suppliers to them, they're all hitting 52-week price and relative strength lows. So, you know, it's certainly suggesting that the rails may be printing money, but they're certainly not, you know, going back to order new cars and refreshing at least, you know, their lineup of what they have. So I when you do look at that sector, it is a hodgepodge of mixed groups in terms of what's performing and what's not. And I would just like to be better prepared in that.
So you're talking about, as you look at your indicators to kind of confirm where the market's going, you made a comment, they're not getting worse, but they're not getting better either. So what does that tell you?
Well, it tells me that there's a few names that are holding most of the group up. You know, when you take a look at something like a 3M, and I notated that on your call a couple months ago, that, you know, a 3M is kind of a good precursor to what's going to happen in the market overall. You know, 3M has taken a nosedive, and they're involved in just about every sector of the economy. It tells me that there's some weakness inherent behind the scenes, and it's not being broadcast through the rest of the equity market at this point in time. I think the Fed is trying to pull on that insurance policy string, that he's inkling that, you know, we may have to move to a loosening, and he certainly may. But I think they're trying to keep this market up. I think we're really in a currency war around the world. And I think the dollar, again, was much too strong, and we need to weaken it. You see the tweets out by our leader in chief suggesting that, you know, if Europe ECB is going to do a rate cut, that's cheating because it's weakening their currency. So it would seem to me that, you know, that's really where the battle is being fought.
And maybe that's what's driving gold. I want to move on to another sector. Let's talk about the treasury market, the inversion. And Dave, I can't remember. I guess we'd have to go back to 2016. There was an article out in the Financial Times this week pointing out that negative sovereign debt is at an all-time almost record at $12.7 trillion. Think of that. You're actually loaning the government money, and the government is charging you interest. I can't remember seeing that until 2016, and here we are a couple of years later, we're right back there again.
Yeah, and it's interesting to note, you know, when I talk to clients, I often ask, you know, do you feel safer investing in Europe or China? You know, the one thing that 9 out of 10 will say, I'd rather invest in Europe. You know, I don't recall, you know, a period in time that you had a 10-year treasury yielding a negative 50 basis points in Germany and has for almost 10 years been almost negative. Not during the last 10 years. They've, you know, again, it's been in and out, but it, you know, that's something that you didn't see, you know, until the likes of Japan post 1989. And it would seem that, you know, most of the industrialized countries around the world are suffering from that. Most of the emerging countries have normalized yield curves. They're paying a positive yield on their 10-year treasury. You know, it makes me wonder, you know, really, where is the problem? And it's got to be debt related.
So when you look at some of the things that we're starting to see, when you see gold, which peaked in 2011, and it's kind of just been sideways or going down for a long period like it is, or it has been, and you see it break out, it almost looks to me, David, like a coiled spring. And maybe what gold is telling us is this currency war that you mentioned, and that's what gold is sniffing out.
I think that's exactly what it's doing. And, you know, there's a number of various patterns associated with what we're seeing. There's an ascending triangle in there. There's head and shoulders bottoms in there as well. You have, you know, again, a breakout taking out, you know, back to the 13 highs. So you're going back six years and looking at a pretty significant base. Which I think is very significant, and it tells, I think, a tale of what the expectations of the dollar are going to do.
Dave, when you're looking at something like this, and gold is looking as it's breaking out on the day you are speaking, do you guys look at upside targets? I know that Paul Tudor Jones, the hedge fund manager, was recently interviewed, and he said if it takes out 1,400, it's going to 1,700. Do you think that's a possibility?
I think that's exactly right on. You had most of your measured moves when you're looking at a base such as this is you take the low from that duration that you're looking at. So if we looked at the low for the last 6 years, you're looking at about 1100, and you're, you know, the breakout's at 1400. So you're going to project that higher $300. And usually that's the minimum objective. That does not indicate that that's the ultimate endpoint. That is the minimum objective measured move from a pattern such as this.
So as you're looking at markets, as you mentioned earlier, you'd like to see some of the cyclical parts of the economy, autos, materials, energy, maybe even the housing, do better. Let's talk about some of the sectors within the S&P. And I think you would probably agree a lot of this has to do with the yield, with treasuries keep dropping down and getting lower. But we've seen staples do well. We've seen REITs do well. We've seen utilities do well. Those kind of stocks that normally are defensive, but I think, you know, the way I look at it, I think this is more of a yield play. What's your opinion?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is, you know, obviously based on, you know, interest rates moving down and defensive. You know, what's interesting is you don't have massive breaks, you know, across all the sectors that are even growth oriented. Technology has held up very well. You know, it was interesting to note that, you know, the stocks actually, you know, reversed right where it should. But, you know, realize it had a run up from December back to taking out the old highs and hitting a new all time high and then retracing about 50% of that move. But overall, you know, technology as a whole, you know, there's a lot of great software names. You do see investors playing more of the defensive side of tech, and that would be the service or IT companies. It was not just a game of, you know, defensive as a whole. There was some offensive areas that could be taken that, you know, were outside of the staples and utility and the REIT sectors.
So as you're looking at the market in your recent piece, you're talking about areas that you think are more prominent to overweight. You talk about communications, services, and technology. Let's talk about those three sectors. What are you seeing there?
At the services side, you know, I think what investors are looking for is reoccurring revenue and something that's less cyclical. So in your services sector, you have names such as MasterCard, Visa, Automatic Data, TTEC. But you're seeing, you know, some significant breakouts hitting new price and relative strength highs. I think those are the areas that I think the world is looking to in order to find, you know, some safety, but still not be, you know, jumping head over heels into the defensive areas in the market, because they do offer, I think, a great risk reward opportunity to the upside. You know, some of the areas within there that we have liked as data processing and outsourcing services group. So it's going to be names like EEFT, BR, EBTC, PayPal, again, MasterCard, Visa, EXPGY, ADP, GPN, FLT, WEX, WP. There's just a number of them, large and small cap IT consulting, government global has been an area. Research consulting services remains leadership. I'm seeing a number of names in the engineering and construction area of the market that are doing quite well. Waste services, uniforms, facility management on the services side.
Those are the areas that you like right now. Let's talk about something that does not look well. And you talk about recently the breakdown in pharmaceuticals. How much of this is politics, or is there something fundamental going on here?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I think they're not seeing the growth they'd like to see. And I think the concern for Medicare for all, or at least having, a consultation about drug pricing. I think that's the main concern in that area. You know, it's interesting to note that the biotechs are actually outperforming the pharmaceuticals. So again, more of a growth bent than a defensive area, you know, bet in terms of where investors are placing their bets in the sector.
So when you're seeing a point, as we are today, where the markets are breaking out to new record levels, what do you do as an investor?
Well, I think it's be patient. We're looking for those inflections. And, I think you have to almost take a barbell approach to the market. And what I mean by that is you do need to be in some of those defensive areas of the market that have been working. Realize interest rates are moving lower. They're not moving higher. But also realize that this is not like a typical bear market in which you see defensive areas hit relative strength highs, but price lows, because that's normally what you would see in a bear market. And that would be A full-blown bear market would be that your staple stocks actually go down, but you hit relative strength highs. In this market, you do have a lot to pick from in terms of sector orientation, or at least groups within sectors. There's something that is working in just about every sector. It may be narrow focused, but at least there's something working. So this is not a normal bear market. And one of the things that I think it reflects in what we saw this, and our group is, recognized this back in 1994, is you had the same, disorientation by investors. And that's where the S&P moved sideways for a year. We've literally been doing that since the beginning of last year. So we've had an 18 months that we've been doing this. Back in 94, it was about a year, but every time you got negative on a sector, it was the bottom and it was in a trading range. And by the end of the fourth quarter, you had the big breakout in technology. Now the question is are we going to see that in technology this time? I really think that this is going to be different. And again, I'm going to allude to, a decade ago, everyone said to buy the emerging markets and you needed some holdings there. You didn't need it for the last 10 years. And I'm wondering if this is a period in time that the industrialized economies of the world are suffering a debt problem. And again, I only point to the negative yield curves on the short end, negative 10-year rates in Europe. If we're not going to see some type of emergence from the emerging markets in terms of starting to be a decade for them.
All right. Well, listen, Dave, as we close, always excellent analysis. If our listeners would like to find out a lot about the work that you guys do, and you do cover a lot of territory, how could they do so?
Yes, you can call us at 952-922-7500, or you can reach us at vermilioncap.com.
All right. Well, great work, Dave, and come back and speak to us again. Have a great weekend.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
The Mexican government wanted to welcome in a lot of these migrants, and they've been taking the stance of, well, we need development. Let's get a lot of money in to solve security issues. Let's solve development issues. And let's invite all of the people who want to leave in. We'll give them jobs, we'll give them education, and we will welcome these people in. And they assumed that a large portion of these, or at least they assumed more than actually ended up participating in these programs, would want to stay in Mexico, would want to start their life there. And the problem is that some people did want to do that, which was great. But the other problem is they did not anticipate the sheer number of people coming north. They did not anticipate that some of these people would realize the wages for manufacturing jobs are higher in northern states than southern states, and perhaps seek out opportunities there. And then there's also your group of people that never had any intention of settling in Mexico and really set their sights on going to the United States. And no matter what Mexico did, it was not going to prevent them from seeking their journey north.
Well, tensions in the Middle East are driving up the price of oil this week, with oil spiking on Thursday as the Trump administration meets as Iran supposedly shot down a U.S. drone. Well, what does this mean for oil? Joining us on the program is Robert Rapier. And Robert, I want to go back, and I think this would be important for our listeners. You wrote an article back on June 7th, Why Oil Prices Have Crashed and What Investors Should Do Now. Let's talk about a couple of reasons that you give for why oil dropped, because according to my recollection, over the last 2 years, we've had four major drops in oil in just a two-year period, including the sharp drop last fall and the sharp rebound at the beginning of the year.
Right. And I think there are two factors that I mentioned in that article. One was overall trade war and the concerns that oil demand is slowing. You know, there were some stories out of China that maybe their oil demand is slowing down. And I think anytime you see these stories, they get a lot of play. And the other thing that happened is when the Trump administration threatened to slap tariffs on Mexico, that really chilled the oil markets, because suddenly refiners are maybe going to have to pay more for imports coming from Mexico. And so you saw those two factors, I think, really, really hit the market. But then The other one, I think, is psychological. And that is, and I saw many, many people that I follow on Twitter, I saw articles say, well, this is it. This is the beginning of the end of the oil age. It's here. This is what it looks like. And, you know, and they point to certain data points. And since then, the BP Statistical Review has come out. And I have been through the data and I've pointed out that, you know, we've talked about Norway before. Norway has the number one per capita electric vehicle fleet in the world. They had triple digit sales for 7 years in a row. Norway's oil demand went up by 5% last year to a new all-time high. China, they have putting out electric vehicles like mad. And I've seen so many people say, yeah, China's oil demand is now flattened and it's going to start declining. Their oil demand was up 5% last year to a new all-time high. According to California Air Resources Board, their gasoline consumption, despite all the electric vehicles they're putting out on the road, has risen about 1% a year since 2012. And so you look at all these actual data points and it looks like, you know, overall, you know, we set a new all-time consumption record for oil last year once again. And so the narrative doesn't quite fit the data. I mean, I think people are cherry picking data points, but investors don't want to get caught like with the coal industry. You know, the coal, that was a little bit different story because, you know, we had a lot of different ways that coal could be displaced. Number one of which was cheap natural gas. We don't have that with oil. We don't have a lot of different ways that oil can be displaced. And so despite all the electric vehicles on the roads, and again, Norway is a perfect case in point, oil demand there should be plummeting given how many electric vehicles they put on the road. And it's just not. But I think it's a fear. I think psychological fear. Anytime, you know, there's a softness in oil, I think we're going to go through this. I think people are going to panic and think, well, we're at the end. We're at the beginning of the end of the oil age.
You know, Robert, that is a common refrain that you often hear in the press. Every time oil prices go down, I hear the EV story. I mean, I don't think people realize what a small fraction EVs make of the automobile market, number one. And number two, the infrastructure necessary to make EVs ubiquitous, not to mention the current prices.
Right. Totally agree. You know, I have nothing against EVs at all. I think they will continue to grow. But I mean, again, all we have to do is look to Norway. We will be years before we're at Norway's level of per capita EVs on the road. I mean, I think I read recently that 60% of new vehicle sales in March. Yeah, that's right. Electric vehicles made up 60% of new vehicle sales in March in Norway. 60%. I mean, we are far, far away from that. The number on the road in Norway per capita as a percentage of the vehicles on the road is far, far higher than us. We won't be there for years. And so, you know, people that think that this is starting to really impact oil demand, I don't think the data supports that at all.
No. And, you know, if you take a look at as much money as we're spending on renewable energy, that was the other thing that the BP Statistical Review picked up. It was not only that oil demand was double last year, but also renewables also grew at a double-digit clip. So they're growing. And obviously, if you're starting from a smaller base, the numbers are going to look much bigger. But, you know, you think of how we get goods, how we travel, how we transport people and goods, it's still run on fossil fuels.
Right. And just to put that in perspective, renewables are growing at a much faster clip than fossil fuels. But overall energy demand grew so much that the fossil fuels increased about four times overall what renewables did. So as you say, it's grown from a small base, but as overall consumption goes, if you put it in terms of, you know, tons of oil equivalent, fossil fuels made up about four times the global consumption increase over the past year that renewables did.
And the other thing that, you know, we talk about all this high technology, whether you're talking about renewables, you take a look at the way our society runs today. We run on an Amazon society. I can't think of a day of the week I'm not getting a package from Amazon. And that means trucks are out there, vans are out there transporting this stuff all around the country. So given this, Robert, what is it about the oil industry? One of the things that you pointed out in your article I thought was interesting, and maybe this is a contrary indicator, and that was that Bloomberg talked about energy is only about 5% weighting in the S&P right now. I can remember, Robert, when it was 12, 13, 14, 15%.
Yeah. And if you look historically, and I think it's even lower than it was when I wrote that article, I think it's dropped down to 4-something%. I mean, if you look historically over the long haul, this is really, really unusually low. And that should be a buy indicator for people. You know, if you look at how things fluctuate up and down, the sectors fluctuate up and down, you know, over the past year, the hot sectors have been real estate and utilities. Utilities are the number one sector in the S&P 500 over the last year. And energy has been out of favor. Energy will be back in favor. We are not at the beginning of the end. We're still a few years out from that. And so I think we will see a rebound in energy. You know, one of the sectors that did hold up very well during this correction, I don't know if you recall, but every time we've talked over the past year, I've said pipelines. Midstream is undervalued. Well, they finally made their move. Some of the midstream companies I've recommended are up 40% since the beginning of the year. And during this downturn, many of them either held steady or some of them even gained a little bit during this downturn. So, you know, the midstream sector is holding up pretty well, still offers a lot of value for income investors. But, you know, some of the other areas, some of the oil producers, even big oil companies, and especially the refiners are seriously undervalued right now, if you look back historically.
You know, what is it, Robert? I don't know, maybe fundamental analysis has gone out of favor, but when you've seen this latest drop in oil from its big rise at the beginning of the year, when prices drop, people don't understand what that means for refiners. It means their raw materials, the things that they have to buy, which is oil, is cheaper, and their margins expand. What is it about the markets they don't understand that?
Yeah, I agree totally. I mean, I pointed this out. I said, really, the sector that should not have been punished, the segment that shouldn't have been punished as a refining segment, they make money when oil prices are falling. And yet, investors sold off energy stocks pretty indiscriminately, except for the pipeline companies. And I said, what happened was the big oil, that sold off. The oil producers sold off. And you say, okay, well, that's understandable because they're directly tied to the price of oil. But when the refiners sell off like that, you say, okay, this just created a big disconnect and a big bargain. And they've bounced back pretty strongly since I wrote that article. I'm just looking at charts. You know, most of the big refiners have come up pretty strong. But, you know, you see the kind of disconnect like that. I bought some Valero whenever, right about the time I wrote that article. I said, this is ridiculous. This can't last. And I think it's up 8 or 10% since then, in the past couple of weeks.
Let me talk about another sector. It's no secret, and the markets are talking about this all the time, the increase in shale production. Most of the increase of oil production in the world has come out of the shale production in the U.S. But Robert, a lot of the shale producers, I mean, they've been kept alive because they've been able to finance. And Wall Street is kind of taking a seat back now saying, you know what, show me the money. What is the possibility, if things do get a little rough here, that some of these companies aren't going to be able to roll over their debt, which they've been able to do up to now? Because the one thing that really strikes me is you've got the big boys. You've got Chevron. You've got Exxon, Occidental Petroleum, Royal Dutch, now moving into shale. And the big boys have capital. The smaller drillers, they don't.
Right. I will say that a lot of these guys are in much, much better shape than they were in 2014 when the downturn happened then. I just wrote an article a month or so ago showing how much cash flow had improved year over year and compared to 2014. I mean, producers are producing more cash flow right now than they did when oil prices were $100 a barrel. So a lot of these guys are in much better shape. You know, they've learned a lesson. A lot of the weak players got squeezed out. But you're right. I mean, if we go through a sustained downturn, you know, if oil prices went back, you know, to sub $50, you'd see ConocoPhillips and EOG Resources and, you know, some of the big guys, they'd be fine. I mean, ConocoPhillips is going to make money at $50 oil, and you might see some of the weak players start to get squeezed out and get bought up by, you know, some of these that don't probably have enough shale exposure, maybe a Shell. Shell doesn't have a whole lot of shale exposure. Chevron, after missing out on the deal in the Permian, may be out shopping again and looking to pick up somebody. So, you know, you may see a little bit of consolidation if oil prices remain low.
Now, given the fact that Chevron walked away from the Devon deal and Occidental scooped it up, you've got Carl Icahn going in there and he doesn't like what he sees. But when you have big elephants like a Chevron shopping around the market, what's the probability, Robert, that, you know, others are doing the same, whether it's Royal Dutch or maybe even Exxon?
Oh, I don't think there's any question. I think they're all looking around. You know, I did several sets of articles after Chevron, you know, missed out on that deal. And I said, all right, who might be next? And, you know, the cheapest company on the books is probably ConocoPhillips, but they're the biggest. And they don't have as much, you know, they're much more diversified globally and they're not focused shale play. And they'd be a really big bite to swallow. I mean, they're the biggest independent oil and gas producer. They've got pretty cheap reserves on the books. And a lot, like Pioneer, jumped double digits when the first Chevron bid for Anadarko was announced. You could see who people think were going to be next by the double-digit spikes in several of the Permian producers. And so I think we will see some more get bought out. I don't think that's over by any means. And I think, you know, the big boys are starting to move in and consolidate. Chevron, you know, unfortunately, when they missed out on that deal, they had put together a very long corridor, 75-mile corridor of just, it would have been all their fields. And that lets them be a little more efficient. You know, they can drill longer laterals. You know, there are a lot of things that they could have done. But when the price went up, I said, you know, Chevron is very financially disciplined, and I think they'll walk away. And a lot of people were predicting that they'd match the bid. And I said, I don't think so. And I wrote an article for Forbes then saying, I believe they'll walk away, and they should walk away because the price has just gotten too high. I mean, they had a good deal. It's not such a good deal anymore.
Well, if you take a look at Carl Icahn going after Occidental Petroleum, he's obviously unhappy in terms of the way it was not presented to shareholders. And a lot of people feel that Occidental overpaid for that. Robert, given where we are right now, and we seem to be rebounding, you know, who knows how long this will last. We know demand is still growing. We're still producing more here in the U.S. Saudi Arabia looks like it's stepping up to the plate with discipline on cutting back. What would you do as an energy investor? It seems to me there are plenty attractive plays in the sector with dividend yields that, gosh, 2-3 times the price of treasuries, not to mention the fact they're growing each year.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of good plays here. I mean, if you've got the risk tolerance for it, I think Valero is, Valero's been a cash cow for years. They pay, dividends hit 5% for Valero, and they're raising their dividends every year, and they're covered by cash flow. So this is not a company that is likely to cut its dividend anytime soon. And it is a little volatile. You will have a little bit of volatility. But Royal Dutch Shell as well, they haven't cut their dividend since World War II. And they're paying, I believe right now, they're upwards of 5% dividend. I mean, that's incredible. Chevron's dividend, I say every time Chevron's dividend gets to 4%, it's a buy. And that has proved pretty accurate over the years that, you know, the share price will run up and dividend will drop toward 3%. But, you know, when there's a correction and the dividend gets pushed up toward 4%, Chevron's usually a pretty good buy at that level. And Chevron has increased their dividends for, I believe, 32 straight years. And that is through the ups and downs of oil prices. So, I mean, Chevron would be on my short list if I was putting together a portfolio of income producing companies.
All right. As we close, you write for several publications, Investors Business Daily, Forbes Magazine, and of course, you have your own newsletter. So if our listeners would like to follow or find out more about your work, what's the easiest way to do that?
Sure. So most of my energy-related articles come out on Forbes first. I usually publish one every Sunday evening, and then sometimes during the week, I'll publish one. I write Utility Forecaster for Investing Daily. The utility sector has been very hot over the last year. We've had a lot of very happy investors. We've outperformed the markets, done very, very well. I loaded up pipelines in the portfolios earlier in the year. So Investing Daily, I write one free article a week for them. It comes out on Tuesdays. And then I've got the subscription letter, Utility Forecaster. And then I've got my own blog, rraypure.com. That's where a lot of my articles that I've written elsewhere end up being hosted there, where you might see oil price pick them up, or Zero Hedge sometimes picks them up, and sometimes even RT, you know, used to be Russia Today, they'll pick them up and strip my name off. And it's funny when I run across one of my articles on their site that looks like they wrote it.
Okay. Well, listen, Robert, lots of bargains in the energy patch. Appreciate you coming on the program.
You bet. Anytime.
Wall Street is in record territory. The dollar is in retreat. 10-year treasuries dipped briefly below 2% as interest rates continue to head lower. Now, all of this is happening as central banks, including our own Fed, begin another global easing cycle. Welcome to the big picture, everyone. As we discuss the Fed's next move, it's likely going to be lowering interest rates. You know, it's just interesting to see how much the world has changed in just a short period of time. Last year was all about raising interest rates, and it was supposed to be the same this year. But the world has changed, and now all the talk is about lowering interest rates. And the markets are obviously liking what they heard at this week's FOMC meeting, that lower interest rates are in our future. Let's listen to a few snippets from the Fed's press conference.
We want to see and we want to react to developments trends that are sustained, that are genuine, and not react just to data points or just to changes in sentiment, which can be volatile. At the same time, we're quite mindful of the risks to the outlook, and are prepared to move and use our tools as needed to sustain the expansion. I don't discuss elected officials publicly or privately, really. So I will just say that we are at the Fed. We're deeply committed to carrying out our mission, and also that our independence from direct political control we see as an important institutional feature that has served both the economy and the country well.
So what does all of this mean for you, the investor?
Haven't a clue. You know, I picture these things. We spend so much of our time on this show, financial cable shows, on Wall Street, following every word the Fed says, you know, every nuance. Well, they changed this word. They changed that word. And, you know, Chris, I was thinking of the movie Macbeth, and I keep picturing this pot of boiling steam coming out with the cone hat on the Fed chairman uttering stuff out as all the sycophants look on and say, oh, my God, what does that mean? But on the serious point, let's talk about what does all this mean? Why is the market reacting in the way it is? First of all, from an investment point of view, when the Fed starts cutting interest rates, it means something is going wrong in the economy or the financial markets. The best operating environment for the markets is when the Fed is actually doing nothing. That means the economy is doing well. The financial markets are doing well. When they're raising interest rates or lowering interest rates, something isn't good. Either inflation is rising or the economy is weakening. Now think about this. The last two times they began to cut interest rates was just as the stock market peaked and several months before the beginning of a recession. Now initially, like this week, the stock market reacts positively to the lower interest rates because from a discounting mechanism, it means everything is worth more. But then at some point, it dawns on investors why they are cutting rates as evidence mounts that the economy is slowing or heading into a recession and corporate earnings begin to fall as the economy weakens. So, Chris, when they're cutting something, that's not a good thing.
Well, and I'm really glad that you're sort of exposing what it really means, because I'm hearing everyone talk about it like it's a very good sign. So what was the message of the Fed this week that the markets reacted in such a positive way?
Well, I mean, the language changed in a major way. And once again, we parse this language. We take a look at keywords in terms of they try to give us a hint at what they're doing. And here are the two takeaways you can walk away with. They change from simply the word patient to act as appropriate to sustain growth, as you heard in that clip. Translation, we're ready to start cutting interest rates. I don't know why they just don't come out and say it. You know, it'd be much easier. They also changed their language on the economy from a solid rate of expansion to one of a moderate rate of expansion. Translation, once again, we see weakness ahead. The other thing that came out, the dot plot, which is their estimate of all the Fed governors or where they see interest rates, the dot plot fell, showing a quarter point interest rate coming next year. Meanwhile, the futures market sees 2 to 3 rate cuts this year. Also, St. Louis Fed Chair James Bullard dissented, and he voted for a rate cut this month.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When the president speaks give some major State of the Union speech or whatever, you always have someone come up afterward that gives their perspective, usually some way of translating it. It's a shame that when the Fed chairman speaks that we don't get someone coming up, like you, Jim, to explain what it really means. But based on that, what are the signs of a weakening economy and accompanying weak corporate profits as implied by that change in Fed statements? And in fact, what are the possibilities, Jim, if any, that either of these events could happen?
Well, if you look at what we've been reporting here and elsewhere in the press, global PMIs are falling, including our own ISM surveys. One in particular, the ISM Manufacturing Index, has been falling steadily since last summer. Now, the current reading of 52.1 is probably the lowest that we've seen since 2016. But on the positive note, it's still above 50, which means the economy is still expanding. Now, the IM service index is also weakening, but it's holding up much better. But take a look at other sectors of the economy. The housing sector is slowing down. The auto sector, we're seeing layoffs and plant closings. In fact, this week, U.S. Steel said it would cut production by idling two blast furnaces in response to falling demand for steel from a weakening manufacturing sector. So here you have the companies that provide raw materials to manufacturing saying that they're cutting back because of what they're seeing on the front end of their sales. Also, the benchmark price of steel has dropped more than 35%. It's probably one reason U.S. Steel is cutting production by 15%, not just because of lower prices, but those lower prices were brought on by falling demand. And it's not just here. It's the same thing as happening abroad. What is now starting to happen and why everybody's so focused on the trade war, it's really starting to impact economies globally. The biggest risk to the economy right now simply is the trade war. The other factor is central banks don't have much ammunition to fight the next downturn, which is why you're starting to hear a lot more about MMT, which is modern monetary theory. This has really caught my attention. Bloomberg's Barclays Global Negative Yield Debt Index hit $12.5 trillion. What that means is the universe of negative yielding bonds has jumped to a new record, with the sovereign debt markets looking very much like they did in 2016. Think about this. Over a third of all government debt has a negative interest rate, meaning that when you buy those bonds, you're going to lose money. Instead of you're lending the government money by buying those bonds, but instead of receiving interest, in effect, you're paying interest to loan them money. That's the state we're in today.
Okay, so your contention is that the Fed talking about cutting interest rates is not necessarily a good thing. You say that it means things are deteriorating on the economic front. So based on that, what do they do to avoid a crisis? And for that matter, can a crisis be avoided?
Right now, central banks are in the midst of another global easing cycle that will soon be led by the Fed. That's why the markets were reacting this week. Fed futures, as of this Friday, are pricing in the 74% probability of a quarter point cut coming in July. The ECB is likely to cut their deposit rate, which is already negative, by year end. And you can forget rate hikes coming from the ECB. More like it's going to be quantitative easing beginning this fall. The Bank of Japan is likely to cut rates to negative 0.3%. China is accelerating credit expansion in response to the trade war. And I don't care anywhere you look around the globe, from Chile to Australia to New Zealand to some of the outer limit countries in Europe, right now they're all slashing interest rates. We're in the middle of a currency war in a rush to slash rates and devalue the currency.
So is this one reason that you made the case for gold last week? And I know you know this, but gold did break out this week, as Dave Nikoski highlighted earlier in the broadcast.
Yeah, I think what gold is telling us here, they're sniffing out a currency war and debasement of currencies around the globe. The untold story here is that gold has been breaking out against most major currencies. Now, if you live in the U.S., gold has been in sort of a trading range, a coiled spring, probably for the last 4 or 5 years. The story we don't hear here, it's up double digits against other currencies. It's up, for example, 30% against the Turkish lira. It's up more than 70% against the Argentine peso. So gold is sniffing out competitive devaluations, and that's why several macro hedge funds are heavily invested in gold. Last week, we played that clip with Paul Tudor Jones. He believes if we take out $1,400 on gold, it's going to $1,700, a figure I asked Dave Nikoski, our technician this week, who basically believes that's a possibility.
So does the Fed avoid crashing the airplane? I think this is what everyone's wondering. I mean, they do seem, if we're going to be honest, they seem to have a knack for crashing the plane. But what are the possibilities of a crisis unfolding here or abroad?
You know, one reason you're seeing negative interest rates, one reason you're seeing the Fed talking about this, we live in a debt-laden world. Everywhere you look around the globe, governments are heavily in debt, including our own. Corporations are in debt. I mean, if we look at, for example, our financial markets here in the U.S., our financial markets are highly geared. Net debt to EBITDA, that's before interest, taxes, depreciation, is 2 times the highest it's been in several decades. Interest coverage has fallen to less than 7 times. And as we have talked numerous times, triple B debt is now 50% of the corporate bond market. Now, given these risks, investors are being complacent. You can see this reflected in high yield spreads, low default rates, and the return of high-risk investments. This week, the Financial Times reported that packages of real estate loans hitting the market are at the fastest rate in a decade, a total of about $8.4 billion of CLOs, that's collateralized loan obligations, have been issued so far this year. That beats last year's record, which was close to $14 billion. Now, for our listeners, CLOs are the riskier cousins of the more mainstream commercial mortgage-backed securities. So what we're starting to see is a vast influx of more complex financial products enter the marketplace because right now there's a global search for high yields. I mean, treasuries are back down to 2%. So it is one reason why, as Dave and I were talking earlier in the broadcast, you're seeing REITs, staples, and utilities lead the stock markets higher within the S&P 500 group. Everyone is scrambling for yield right now, and they're ignoring risk.
Well, Wall Street is seeing this in different ways. One is positive, the other is negative. I want to play a sample of some of those different views.
I think that it's very reasonable to think there's two cuts this year. With this change in the dot plot, it's very clear that the Fed is really looking to ensure that the expansion continues. And it's positive for the market. I mean, this is what the market needed to see. The rates market is pricing this in. So this is all in sync. So pretty good. It's a good statement for the market.
I think the stock market may like this in the short run, but I think we're in some dangerous territory here. I mean, first of all, two wrongs don't make a right. And it's inappropriate to have a overly easy monetary policy to enable an overly aggressive trade policy. I hope people in Washington get.
By the way, do you think anyone on the Fed is actually trying to enable an aggressive trade policy?
I think the problem is the Fed has taken the position that monetary policy should be independent, and therefore they will not tell the administration what to do if the administration would please stop telling them what to do. Now, one part of them is, you know, one side is keeping that agreement, but the danger here is that if they ease, you know, the first thing is if they cut in July, everybody's going to expect them to cut again. 81% of the time, when the Fed cuts, they cut again within the next 6 months. So people will just build in a series of rate cuts, and as rates fall, people will expect, well, no, why don't I wait a while here, see if I can borrow at cheaper rates? It doesn't stimulate the economy, so there's a danger that they will actually make things worse by cutting rates in this environment.
So let's bring this back to investing, Jim. What do investors do at this point, given the risks that you've outlined that are out there?
You know, given our view, Chris, that things continue to deteriorate, which is why you saw the Fed make the statements it did this week, you have to take a defensive view here. I like dividend value stocks that have been beaten up by the market. You heard Robert Rapier mention refinery stocks, which is, it just goes to show you that fundamentals aren't driving this. Because if you look at the energy sector, what does falling oil prices imply? It means if you're a refiner, the stuff that you buy, your input costs are cheaper. And that's why a lot of these refiners have been increasing their dividends at double-digit rates and why their dividend yields are in the 4% range. So, you know, they've been mispriced by the market. Also, in the energy sector, you can get dividend yields of 4 to 6%, which is, when you think about it, with two-year treasuries, it's almost 2 to 3 times what you can get in the treasury market. There's gold, which we covered last week, which broke out this week. I know it's very easy to ignore risk when you see the markets heading higher, as we now see, But, you know, folks, take a step back and look what is happening below the surface. Think about this. The Fed isn't talking about cutting interest rates because the economy is booming. More likely, they're doing this because a recession is looming. And unlike the last time central banks started cutting interest rates to ward off a crisis and recession, we begin this cycle with nearly a third of all sovereign debt and negative interest rates, and the Fed funds rate is half of what it was before the Great Recession. Now, right now, the futures market is pricing in about 1.1% cut in the Fed funds rate over the next year and a half. So U.S. Treasuries, which are close to 2% and falling, will still be the highest yielding sovereign debt among the G10 countries. So what is the message of the bond and stock markets telling investors? I would go with the bond market, as the bond market gets it right more often than compared to, let's say, the stock market. You don't want to be completely out of stocks, and the ones you own should be defensively positioned, as I mentioned, like the high dividend stocks and value stocks. But you also don't want to be completely all in either, as I discussed last week with my three reasons you should be looking at gold. You may want to look at gold markets, adding that as a hedge to your portfolio. The gold and bond markets are the markets, and in my opinion, you should be watching closely. They're telling you a different story than the stock market. And you, as an investor, have to decide which market you put your trust in. From my perspective, I'm siding with the bond and gold market. Deflation lies ahead of us, in my opinion.
So, Jim, what do you see coming up in the weeks ahead?
Coming up in the weeks ahead, we will have the first half of the year over. So in the next month, we're going to be looking at key economic numbers, GDP, the ISM figures, and we're going to watch to see if this slowdown trend continues. Also, we'll be looking at corporate earnings. Now, right now, with the stock market up, Wall Street is anticipating that earnings will be up 10 to 12%. We're not buying that. I think if you got a weakening economy, typically you see weakening earnings. So that's going to be one of the big factors we're going to be looking at. And of course, at the end of the month, will they or will they not cut interest rates? Right now, the futures market by 80% says the probabilities are high. So we could be looking at the first interest rate cut since 2007. All of that coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.